I'm never going to remember what his character's name was. It doesn't matter to me.
It's Quentin Beck, if you need it.
Welcome back to Snark Squad Pod. My name is Marines.
I'm Nicole Sweeney, and this week we are joined by Taylor and Sam. Hello.
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 I'm Taylor Simons, and I'm the author of Collateral Damage.
I'm Sam, and I'm a co-host of SciShow Tangents podcast and Real Love podcast and other stuff, I guess. I can't remember any other podcasts I'm on, but I'm sure I'm on some other ones.
Just the podcast, you know.
Yeah.
So Taylor and Sam are joining us this week to talk about Spider-Man Far From Home, which we have previously been making our way through all of the MCU movies as, you know, on a journey. But after Endgame, we decided to do our own sort of universe reset. And Taylor and Sam are here to talk about this movie with us. But first, I'm going to tell you what the heck this movie even was. So Far From Home takes place shortly after the events of Avengers Endgame. We are treated to a glorious in memoriam montage for all of the deceased Avengers set to Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You. This is part of a high school morning news show, which also explains that, you know, as a result of the unsnap, half the student body has returned the same age as they were at the time of the first snap, while the other half aged 5 years during that time. Conveniently, everyone in our boy Peter's life also blipped, except of course the now deceased Tony Stark. There's also a bit of prologue in which we see Nick Fury and Maria Hill investigating this weird dust storm monster thing in Mexico, where they also meet up with Jake Gyllenhaal wearing a crystal ball on his head. Peter is gearing up to go on a class trip to Europe, where he has this like grand plan to tell MJ that he likes her. The world, however, keeps reminding him that Tony Stark is dead, and even though he is a child, he also was sort of Tony's surrogate son, which kind of makes him like heir apparent to the job of the next Tony Stark. Throughout this movie, Peter is struggling with sort of all of the conflicting feelings of wanting to be the teenage boy that he in fact is, while also dealing with his grief at the loss of his surrogate father, and also just like the general pressure of all of these expectations being placed on this small child. An aquatic version of the dust storm monster thing shows up in Venice while Peter is there with his class, and he has to, sans spider suit, help defeat it. Though Jake Gyllenhaal, soon to be dubbed Mysterio, shows up and does most of the sort of monster defeating. Nick Fury brings Peter into what I assume is like the Venice HQ and explains that Mysterio has arrived from an alternate dimension version of Earth, in which Earth was destroyed by the four elementals, and they are now here to destroy Earth. Mysterio has defeated three of them, but there's one more, and it's fire, and it's coming to Prague, and if they don't stop it, it will destroy Earth. Peter doesn't want to do this because he's a child, and also because he wants to, like, you know, do
he just needs a nap.
Yeah. He wants to do a summer vacation. And he's also like, look, Spider-Man can't be seen in Europe because like my anonymity is important to me because like I'm a child and like I can't do this. I need to go to high school. He tells Nick Fury that it seems like Mysterio has this, and so he's just gonna keep doing his class trip. But Nick Fury basically reroutes his class trip to Prague. They just like, get a mysterious bus shows up and is like, hey, you got an upgrade and now you're going to Prague. And so they do. While they were at this Venice HQ, Peter receives this sort of final gift from Tony, which is a pair of sunglasses, pair of douchey Tony Stark sunglasses, and he puts them on the bus to Prague and realizes that they are in fact super high tech glasses that give him control of all of the like Stark security systems, including like a fuck ton of drones that are just swarming the Earth, and that's a thing. And so Peter now has all of this power. More sort of teenager shenanigans are also kind of happening at this time. Once they get to Prague, his plans with MJ keep getting thwarted by hero stuff, but he, you know, shows up, does the thing, helps defeat the sort of big bad fire monster. Mysterio seemingly almost dies in the process, but like manages to make it through. And then afterwards, he and Peter sit in a bar and like chat about how hard things are. And Peter decides that since Mysterio is going to stay in this dimension, since, you know, his dimension's Earth is fucked, and he's just going to hang out, that it seems like maybe he's the one, that Mysterio should be the one to take on the Tony Stark mantle. And so Peter tells the glasses to hand over all of the controls of the glasses, which were biometrically linked to him, to hand that over to Jake Gyllenhaal. I'm never going to remember what his character's name was. It doesn't matter to me.
It's Quentin Beck.
As soon as Peter leaves, Jake Gyllenhaal mugs to camera and everything in this bar starts changing. And we realize that, in fact, this was all an illusion. It was like a very elaborate ploy. And even after his death, Tony Stark has managed to breed one last round of villains. And we get sort of a brief, like kind of intentionally comical sort of background on why all these people in the bar were, you know, for some reason or another, slighted by Tony Stark. And now they fucking hate him.
They're all petty, I guess.
Yeah. They're basically all incredibly petty. It's like, but it's a story we've seen so many times in the MCU, right? Like somebody who... Yeah. Nick, when we were talking about all the MCU movies, talked about this all the time, about all the ways in which Tony Stark made his own villains. And so this is like, we've seen this sort of ominous villain backstory many times throughout the MCU, but because this is now in a Spider-Man movie, this whole montage has more of a comic feel to it than it did in any of the sort of Iron Man movies. Anyway, the point is, all of this was an elaborate illusion. Everything that people were seeing was actually fake, and they were using EMPs to sort of knock out SHIELD satellites and stuff so that nobody knew, nobody could sort of prove that it wasn't fake. And all of this was a ploy specifically to get Peter to hand over the glasses and then to create, in the sort of climax of the movie, an Avengers level event, which Mysterio would save the world from. And thus, like, by virtue of sort of showing up as a new Avenger level hero, have access to the sort of microphone, basically. Like, that's his goal, is that he wants to be an authority, to be somebody that people listen to. After this latest catastrophe to rock this school trip, the school trip is canceled and all these parents want their kids to come home. So Peter, in sort of a last ditch effort, goes to tell MJ his feelings, but she stops him because she's sure that what he wants to tell her is that he's Spider-Man. And in her, like, no, that guy who saved us was definitely Spider-Man, not some sort of fake European knockoff, she pulls out this thing that has Spider-Man's web on it, and they realize that it is a projector of some sort. And like, they sort of put together what Mysterio's whole endgame is. Peter realizes what he's done with the glasses. The sort of final showdown is set to take place in London. They all end up in London. Peter gets defeated, but then comes back and then saves the day, stops Mysterio, saves the day, gets the girl, you know, happily ever after, until the first of these credit scenes features Jake Gyllenhaal's like final contingency plan, I guess, which is a video that he recorded, which shows his final confrontation with Peter, but manipulates it so that it looks like Peter is the one who orchestrated everything because he wanted to be the next Iron Man. And this video also outs Peter. So he no longer has his anonymity. And then the second credit scene is actually not really super relevant to this movie, but basically that Nick Fury has been in space the whole time. This is the second one, is just for future movie stuff. But yeah, so that is this movie. That was a fucking mess.
Wow. It didn't feel like so much while I was watching, but that was a whole lot of plot.
There's so much, okay? And there's like a
very convoluted movie.
Nicole mentioned that we had previously gone through the MCU in a whole, like, to do, basically. We had multiple episodes catching up before Endgame. So before we jump into this movie, I just kind of want to touch base with Taylor and Sam and hear briefly what your relationship with the MCU is. Are you, like, caught up? And what your relationship with Spider-Man is?
Well, okay, anybody who's been on my Twitter page knows what my relationship with Spider-Man is. I'm very caught up with the MCU. I've seen every movie multiple times in theaters. I've always been a huge fan. I'm like a midnight premiere kind of person, and Spider-Man is my all-time favorite superhero. Done. He's always been my favorite, and yeah, I'm definitely caught up. Definitely a huge Spider-Man fan.
You also love superheroes in general, right? Like that's your book.
I do. That's the book that I wrote, was superheroes from a background extra with no powers perspective. So I like superheroes a lot. She doesn't, but I do.
I also am all caught up with the movies and love them and seen them a million times, and I'm not ready to stop watching them yet, even though it seems like some people have given them up, like Nick, for instance. And I think like I'm a lapsed comic book reader, but Marvel comics are the ones I read when I go back to them. And Spider-Man, I mean, he's my favorite movie superhero, not necessarily my favorite comic book superhero, but I'm always all in for a Spider-Man movie, definitely.
So back to where we usually start. Did you like Spider-Man Far From Home?
So I've seen it 3 times this week already, and two of them were on the same day. So yeah, I liked it.
I liked it, but I was also, compared to Homecoming, disappointed with it, I think.
Ooh, that is very interesting to hear, because I think I liked this more, but I'm excited to talk to you about it to find out why. I definitely very much enjoyed this movie. I had a blast.
I also really, really liked it. And I like this movie, but also sitting in the theater and like watching this and after I finish or whatnot, I had this moment of like really getting why people like Spider-Man as a hero. Uh-huh. I was like, oh, I love him too. My goodness. Like, I didn't previously know that I loved him as much as I did after Far From Home. And I've seen Homecoming twice, maybe once or twice, but now it's so long ago that I can't really compare them. Some of the more negative things about Homecoming stick out to me, so I'm not sure how they compare, but I really did love this movie. I'm curious, you know, it's hard to talk about this one and not talk about Endgame, and the movie doesn't, you know, step away from that either. Mm-hmm. It feels like an after Endgame kind of movie. So how did you like the pieces that connected the two movies? How did you like the continuation of the story?
I had no idea what they were going to do going into it, because Endgame felt like such a finale. It felt like if they never made another MCU movie, not that I would have been happy, but that it would have been okay, because it felt like the ending of a story. So this was such a huge transition piece into the next phase of the MCU that I really didn't know, in terms of character growth, and especially in terms of like conflict and villain. I was like, I don't know where you go from a villain that has been set up for so many movies and that was such a powerful threat and that actually succeeded. Like, I don't know where one goes from this. And I was really pleasantly surprised by what they did. I thought that the scale and like the increase in scale between, like, in terms of Spider-Man movies between Homecoming and Far From Home, like who the villain was and what they wanted and what the stakes were, was so incredible. And I thought that in terms of like a Spider-Man versus villain movie, it was like the stakes were so high and Mysterio was such a threat because he was so unhinged. Mm-hmm. I thought he was a really, really great juxtaposition to what we had before, which was someone who was so powerful and whose, you know, fatal flaw was his conceit, that this one was just somebody who was so over the top, so unhinged, so willing to like risk everything, that he was really, really threatening. And I loved what they did with his character. And I knew that he was going to be the villain, you know, like anybody who's even a little bit familiar with the comics is like, oh, Jake Gyllenhaal, mm-hmm. like that character, that's the villain. Like, you can't set him up. I know you're trying to set him up as the hero, but he's not. And they still managed to make him feel unpredictable and fresh. And I really loved that.
Yeah, I definitely did not realize, like, I think in one of the earlier trailers, something about it or something that I read, I'm not sure why, but I was like, oh, I, you know, this is, I guess he is playing the villain, but like maybe there's some sort of trick happening in, yeah. I think like that was like the sense that I got from one of the first trailers. And I don't know if it was from the trailer itself or from something that I had heard, but that was far enough removed from my brain by the time that I came into this movie that I really did not know. I was like, he seems pretty solidly like a good guy, I guess. Like,
yeah.
Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I read the wrong thing. And because I don't know the comics. So.
And I do. And I still thought like, oh, maybe they're going in a different direction. Okay.
He's such a, Jake Gyllenhaal is such a great choice for that part too, because he can use his like, he can make his like handsome Hollywood man face, but then he can flip that switch where his eyes just look like he just has like this craven look on his face.
Yes. That the face, the turn of his countenance in the reveal was golden. Like that sort of mug to camera. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Because he's having so much fun with it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I knew that Jake Gyllenhaal was going to be the villain. But my thought was like, oh, well, maybe they'll set him up as the hero for most of this and leave it open where like you can see where he's turning by the end. Mm. So it'd be like a multiple villain kind of thing. So when it turned, when it did, I was like, oh, snap, here we go.
That would have been an interesting multi-movie arc, though, to just end it with the suggestion that the whole thing was fake. Mm-hmm. Maybe it would have been spread out a little too much, but
that's too Inception. I can't do it.
Yeah.
I do want to talk about just like the idea of Mysterio and what he represents. I think it's really interesting that for me, his like the thing that he was doing speaks to some of my sort of like great existential fears about the world that we're living in. And so the fact that the villain of this teenager, like this current sort of teenage superhero, is basically deep fakes. Like is really interesting as a choice, and I say interesting in a good way. But I think like when I say that I thoroughly enjoyed this movie and really appreciated this movie, a lot of that for me comes down to how much I appreciated him as a villain, because it's like it is not something that we have seen previously in the MCU, but also it feels very real.
It is something we've seen in the real world, right? And not a superhero.
Right. World. I mean, yes, this is like something that we're seeing now. And I also think it's really interesting too, just in the context of Peter as a younger hero. Like that's also so much of his story, is that he is a teenager. And so I think it's really interesting that he in particular was given this villain.
So post-Endgame and coming into this story, I felt for Peter and his loss of Tony, but I also hate Tony Stark.
Right,
And so, like, going through this, I was like, are we going to do this, like, memorializing thing to the point where we forget, like, all of the bad stuff? I know, like, he's dead, don't speak ill of the dead. Like, I didn't want it to be like, well, that, thank God Tony's gone. But also it started reaching a point where I was like, okay, like now this is getting a little ridiculous, the amount of like Tony that was going on. But then to turn it around and have the villain be a product of Tony and his decisions and everything, I thought that was like a nice balance. And maybe the movie didn't like directly call that out, like, you know, we're remembering him, but it was there. It existed. The fact that, you know, Peter had his grief, the world was mourning Tony. Tony did a really good thing at the end, but also Tony did a lot of stuff that pissed people off. And here is this final group of heroes, maybe final, I don't know, maybe we'll just keep having people come out of the woodwork, but probably. Here's this group of villains that Tony also had a hand in creating.
Yeah.
Well, even the like when J. Jonah Jameson is Alex Jones at the end, one of the things he calls out that Spider-Man has now is like this drone, this like invincible drone army in the sky. So that is just further like horrible decision making on Tony's part, that he can give Peter Parker something that can accidentally drone strike his friends.
Yeah. And also I was thinking about the like pre-climax scene when Happy and Peter are talking on the plane, and it's the first time that they actually talk about Tony, I think, in the movie. For the rest of it, it's all just kind of subtext or like you know, giant paintings behind him, but in terms of like actually confronting their emotions, and he doesn't say, you know, oh, like Tony was the greatest hero the world has ever known, and like, you know, the world feels this hole in his absence. It was like, Tony was my best friend and he was a mess, and he was trying his best, but like he had all of the stuff that was wrong with him, and nobody expects you to be him and nobody expects you to replace him. Like, all you can do is do your best. And I really, really liked that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's especially beautiful in this, you know, like coming of age story. Like that's very much Spider-Man's whole jam. To have his sort of hero, have hit the person that he is looking up to be Tony Stark for those reasons, right? Like if it, you know, I don't know, if his person were Steve, like I don't know what you'd say in that situation, right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, you're right. He was perfect. You're never gonna be him. Sorry.
Sorry about you.
I was actually thinking about like his relationship with Iron Man in terms of like what his like thematic motivators are in his movies. And in Homecoming, it was like, I need to impress Tony. And in this one, it was like, I need to replace Tony. So like moving forward, I'm so excited to see like what the next step in this journey is, because I think it's him moving past both of those and like finally being like, I am my own person separate of Tony.
Yes. Yes.
And probably, you know, the big bomb at the end to this, that he's no longer just Spider-Man, he's Peter Parker and Spider-Man, and everybody knows. So kind of coming into his own, part of the reason that I was sitting in the theater like, oh my god, I do love Spider-Man too, is like the realization that he is coming of age as a superhero. Like that's his whole jam. And they keep finding ways to keep him like coming of age.
Right, like what Taylor just described is another coming of age movie. Right, like,
yes, absolutely.
He can't catch a break. I'm so stressed out.
Yes, that credit scene. I was so happy when the movie ended. I was like, that was so fun. I am in such a good mood. And then that credit scene like destroyed me emotionally.
Me too. I went to the midnight premiere. So I was there with like everybody that was already like half dead from exhaustion and like emotion and everything. And like everyone's like, oh, so happy. And then J.K. Simmons as Jonah Jameson came on screen, and I swear nobody even heard any of his lines because we were all screaming so loud. I don't even know what he said. And then Mysterio came back and we're like, what's happening? And he like outed him, and everyone was like, like 3 a.m. It was horrible. It was a mess.
Which is also a thing too, like I mentioned the sort of deep fakes as teenager villain, like the outing plot line also feels like something that I don't know, feels particularly relevant because this is a younger hero's story.
And he didn't get a chance to like shape his own narrative on the subject, you know. And there are parallels here to the end of Iron Man, because the end of Iron Man is Tony Stark saying, I am Iron Man, you know. And he gets to be the one to like tell that to the world. Mysterio took that moment from Peter, so he's like wrenching him even further away from the like Tony Stark Iron Man parallel.
Damn.
Yeah. Iron Man's rich. He can do whatever he wants in the wheel. Nobody can get to him.
This is true.
Yeah.
It's also really tough because, you know, you spend the whole movie watching Peter like struggle with this and struggle with wanting to do the team thing and struggle with wanting to be the hero, but maybe not be the hero in a way that will lead people to realize who he is. So that's the whole movie, is him juggling both of these things. And then you get to the end and you're like, cool, that was a great movie. And there's like, haha,
it was all
the
thing nothing.
You just watch like the whole struggle. It's over now. So, I mean, not in a way that I think messed up my enjoyment of the movie overall, but it was just kind of a kick in the feels and a good way to get you to want to see what happens next.
Oh my god, I need the next movie immediately. I think that struggle is why so many people connect with Spider-Man as a character in the first place, because I can't think of a character who better embodies that struggle between like being a superhero and being a normal person than like Peter Parker. I think that that's always been such a central part of his character in a much broader and more like more grounded way than any of the other superheroes that I can think of. Like, you don't really think about like Steve Rogers having to balance being Steve Rogers and Captain America. They're both like intrinsically the same person, and Peter Parker and Spider-Man have always been two separate kind of two separate people. Even the way they interact with people is different. He puts on a mask and he puts on a different persona, and now that persona's gone.
He's the work-life balance superhero.
We've touched on like so much just going through this, but I kind of want to bring it back around. We talked about Jake Gyllenhaal as the villain, but we haven't talked about Tom Holland or Zendaya as MJ. So I want to hear your thoughts on their performances, how you thought that went.
The problem is that once I start talking about Tom Holland, like, I don't know how to stop. So someone's going to have to stop me. I'm just kidding.
I mean, I basically will agree with you that he is perfect.
He's probably the perfect Spider-Man. I've been a Spider-Man fan for my entire life, and my first experience with Spider-Man actually wasn't the, like, in terms of like visual media, wasn't the comic books. It was the TV show Spectacular Spider-Man. So for me, like, that was always my base, you know, like that, and that sort of like shy, awkward geekiness, but being very approachable and grounded and sweet and like someone that you want to take care of and someone that you want to like see succeed. and so I never really connected with like the Tobey Maguire, Andrew Garfield for a number of reasons. And Tom Holland just nails the character, you know, and everyone, like, this isn't news. Like, people, we know this. We know he nails the character. He's just, you just want to protect him. It's fine. So to prevent myself from like talking too much about Tom Holland as Peter Parker and Spider-Man, because I feel like the fact that he just embodies the character so perfectly is just kind of like, we're all on the same page with that. I do want to talk about Zendaya as MJ, because I freaking love Zendaya as MJ, and I loved her in Homecoming, and I really, really like the sort of like edgy, dark drawl that she has, and her humor is very dark and very funny, and she's got all these quick, snappy like one-liners, and you get the feeling that like she doesn't care what anybody thinks of her. She's very comfortable with herself. She's comfortable like being around other people, even though she doesn't really like make friends easily, because she doesn't wear a mask. Mm-hmm. She's unapologetic herself. And having said that, I feel like there were a lot of moments in this movie where MJ was talking to Peter Parker where it felt like she was acting like a different person. And I don't know how to explain that. It was a lot of like when they were in Prague and they were talking like at her doorframe, like in her hotel room. Or like when they were back in the hotel after she found out that he was Spider-Man, and her vocal tone was higher and her facial expressions were different. And, she just was doing a little more of like the wide-eyed, like traditional kind of like superhero love interest kind of thing. And it didn't really match with what she'd been doing before. And so I feel like where they were going with that was like, oh, the like cool girl thing was actually a persona, and she is actually just as awkward as he is. And I was like, I liked the idea of her being just like this cool girl and him being like awkward around her. And she can like have feelings and like him without having to match his awkwardness. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. I think she was a more realized character in the first one, kind of, than in this one.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel that way about a few of the side characters. Like Ned, I miss Ned in this movie. He seemed like a different person to me. And he had a few lines that I thought were weird. Like Peter's like walking away to go fight the bad guys, and he says, just remember, we're all counting on you.
Yeah.
It's like, why are you saying that?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You're supposed to be helping him.
That was so weird.
Yeah. Just like a weird, it was a different writing team. And I could feel that in like the humor of it and in the way that they used the characters just wasn't like as cohesive as it was to me in the first one, at least. But like Peter and Mysterio were so good, and like their interactions with Nick Fury to some degree were really good too, that they kind of just got pushed off to the side, but they're kind of the heart of the movie series.
Yeah, I agree. Because his whole thing is that he wants to be with his friends, and he wants to protect his friends. And so in order to do that, you should have a very strong like friend base. And it felt like for me, the best scene that I can think of like to point to is like, yes, this is the perfect example of like good Spider-Man school friend dynamics is in Homecoming when they're at like debate practice, and they're all like, all their lines are so quick and they're all bouncing off of each other, and everybody has like two lines, but their personalities just shine. Totally. You know what I mean? And I felt like that dynamic wasn't as present in this movie.
Yeah. Mm. Yes. I think there was a lot of very understated character building in Homecoming that was just way more subtle and way more like watching Vulture and Peter like play with each other in the car ride to the dance and stuff, that there just wasn't like that subtlety of humor and subtlety of like emotional range that the first one had.
I agree. The one character I will say who had like all of the funny lines was Mr. Harrington. Like, he stole every scene that he was in. I loved him in this movie. I just wanted everyone to be on his level.
I will say that my big complaint with Homecoming or one of them was, I don't even remember her name now, which is such a shame, but the love interest in the first movie, Liz, who was basically just used as like love interest fodder. And the way that she was portrayed, we talked about it, you know, like not enjoying it as much. I feel like this movie started to try and take a turn where MJ was the one who found the projector. She was the one who, like, she had the like mace in her hand and she was like coming to save him or whatnot. So they were trying to give her a more active part, I feel like, but it's still not quite there, especially when, like, you know, she's the love interest. There was the blonde girl who was, dating each love interest. And then all the Aunt May jokes about how hot she was, like, and all of that was still kind of there. So I feel like it's getting better, but it's not quite there.
You tried.
I agree.
Yeah.
It felt a little forced. And I think, like, there was that scene in the hotel room after they find the projector when Ned walks in and he's like, so you guys are working the case together. And she's like, it's mostly been me. And I was like, you found it last scene. What are you talking about? And it all just, it felt like, I don't know if maybe they like cut a bunch of stuff. It felt like there were like character moments that, or lines that people were saying with no setup.
Yes, yes, totally.
Yeah, maybe in that part they were like conflating her figuring out he was Spider-Man with the mystery of Mysterio a little bit. Because that was like the same scene. She was cracking a lot of cases in that one particular
scene. Right, yeah, she was cracking a lot of cases at once. And so, she'd been doing investigative work while Spider-Man was doing like saving work, but like he wasn't, you know, investigating things. She was investigating, so.
Yeah, he didn't even want to do anything.
You know when she starts talking to him about like, I know you're Spider-Man, and she had like all these reasons? I thought she was going to say, when they were on the bus going to Prague and he's like, look at the baby mountain goats, and everybody looks out the window, she stares right at him as he uses his spider powers to jump straight out of the roof of the bus and then jump back in. She's staring at him the whole time, and I thought that's what she was gonna be like, hey, I know you're Spider-Man because I watched you on the bus.
I like literally watched you do a thing that a normal teenage boy would not be able to do.
And it was like they forgot about that. It was weird. And then like in that same scene, like the way that she was talking was very like, well, I know like you're Spider-Man. And like I said, like her vocal inflection was different. It didn't feel like the same character to me. And I don't know why they did that.
Yeah. Then they sort of even undercut that by having her be like, oh, I was only 67% sure that you
were Spider-Man. Yeah.
He's obviously Spider-Man. Everybody knows he's obviously Spider-Man.
I just want to add a couple more sense of love and appreciation for Tom Holland. I'm coming back around.
Do it.
Just to say that every time he put on his cry face, I was devastated. Yeah. He makes such a good cry face and he turns all red and splotchy and I just want to hug him, and he does such a good job.
He wipes his boogs away from his nose and snorts.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so good.
It's true. I just want to protect him.
And they had that one shot. They had that one shot where he's in the stealth suit, so all you could see was his eyes, like his red eyes.
Yes.
And I was like,
yes.
Nick Fury so rude to him.
I know.
Wait, I have a question about that. My brain has been eating itself trying to figure this out, so maybe somebody else can help me. Okay, you know how in the second credit scene we learned that Nick Fury was never actually on Earth, that he's been in space the whole time, and it was actually the Skrull. So, granted that. So, like, the assumption would be, like, okay, this whole time, the Skrull has been Nick Fury. Or Nick Fury has actually been a Skrull. But also, Mysterio can cause projections. And there were so many moments where Nick Fury said things that directly opened a window for Peter to feel belittled or, like, not good enough, where Mysterio would come in and fill that hole and be there for him and support him. And that was manipulating him into relying on him and, like, more and more. I'm trying to figure out if any of the scenes that we saw Nick Fury in were actually, like, it wasn't even the Skrull. It was just a projection. Like, any of the times that...
Now in my head it is now. Because it would make more sense than, like, drawing a super secret spy organization into all of your very intricate...
Taylor.
And then, okay, so when they go back at one point to the HQ, like, he drops the illusion and it's just like an abandoned warehouse.
Yeah.
So is the illusion that it's HQ or is the illusion that it's the abandoned warehouse? Because if it's that it's HQ, then everything that happened at HQ was all an illusion.
I believe that everything that happened at HQ is an illusion. Like, I don't think
which
Nick
HQ?
Fury- I don't think Nick Fury was ever there. I think that the person who came and picked him up in the car was always an illusion.
Damn.
But then that Nick Fury didn't disappear when all the other illusions disappeared.
Yeah. Because I think that was part of the trick. Because later, after the like big like trippy hallucination thing, Nick Fury like shoots there. He gives him like a hallucination of Nick Fury shooting Quentin Beck, and I feel like the purpose behind not making Nick Fury dissolve with everybody else was to make that part of the, like, thinking forward, like, to make that part of the trick work. Like, I think it was all like all scripted, like all choreographed like that. I don't think he was ever there.
Oh, yes. Oh, I misunderstood which instance of Nick Fury being in a place we were talking about.
That's fair.
So yes, in that instance, I agree.
Yes.
I'm going to say that it was 50% illusion, 50% Nick Fury. Great. Or Nick Fury.
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever.
That checks out.
Fake Nick Fury.
Yeah. That checks out.
Yeah, because he would have had to have... I feel like he would have had to have been there when they bring him to like the Little Shield HQ.
Yeah, the one in Venice. That had to have been. That's what I thought we were talking about before. I was like, no, that had to have been him because the rest of the plot doesn't make sense unless was really him. Yes.
Venice was definitely Skrull Nick Fury, and so was London. Because Venice was when he gave him the glasses and London was when they defeated Mysterio. But it's really the Prague one that's tripping me up because Prague was where like Nick Fury just kept beating on Peter, like, you're not good enough, maybe Tony Stark was wrong about you, like, and they never like specifically say it, but I just feel like
I buy that, especially because like one of the things too is that the idea that Nick Fury wasn't really Nick Fury just in general, I like that credit scene is there in part because without it, there is an element of making Nick Fury worse at his job than he actually is.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
And so, like, I'm glad that we acknowledge that that's not actually Nick Fury, but that what you are describing in terms of the scene in Prague, even the Skrull pretending to be him, that still like that seems like. Like, you're really bad at this faking. Like, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, why would you do this? Yeah. Like, why would you do this in this way? Unless you are actually Mysterio trying to manipulate this situation into being, which and in that case, it feels like it's him building on something that he saw the fake Nick Fury doing in the scene in Venice. Like, so like, okay, I see, I'm sensing like a little bit of the vibe that's going on here. Cool. This is my in. And then sort of using that in Prague. Yes, I love this theory.
Right.
I love this.
Yeah, me too.
Thanks. I've seen it 3 times. I've been thinking about it a lot.
I hated the Skrull thing, kind of.
Oh, really?
That, I did too.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I think because I liked the interactions between Nick Fury and Maria Hill so much in this one.
Oh.
That there was character building that went on with them that I appreciated. And I kind of liked his excuse that he's been gone for 5 years. So now he is bad at his job. I don't know. Just something about it didn't work for me and felt kind of cheap, I guess.
Interesting.
Yeah. I agree.
It was a reveal with nothing else. It was a reveal at the end of the movie. So we didn't get any like, okay, why? Like there was no follow up.
I mean, it's set up. It's not. Yeah, it's set up for something else.
Right, right. It is a setup, but it's a setup that was a reveal for what we just watched. So again, it was like that little piece at the end that kind of changed everything that you just watched with like no more movie. You did this to me at the end. So I totally get like feeling like about that. And I guess when we see whatever comes next, it might color how we view that reveal, but we don't know
so
yet.
So I did actually have the observation, though, at some point during the movie, and I forget during, you know, which one of Nick's many kind of condescending chats with Peter it was, but there was one that stood out to me as a moment of, like, I was briefly taken out of the movie to have the thought, like, you are bad at this solely to advance this plot line for Peter.
Right.
In much the same way that Ned, I think the Ned example is definitely a much more glaring example of a character behaving in a way that doesn't make any sense other than we need to get Peter somewhere. But there was one conversation in particular, and I don't remember which one it was, but I remember having the thought, like, why is Nick Fury so bad at this right now? and so for me, I liked that reveal because it, like, closed what was, you know, like, it closed a loop for me.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
It just seems like on his part, it's a very risky maneuver to leave an exact duplicate of you on Earth, but who also doesn't know any of the stuff that you know, or, like, would never act the way that you act.
Yes.
And he's in charge of, like, national, like, Earth security. And especially when all of the people who would care that Nick Fury is around are dead, or, like, it doesn't seem like that he's that important of a central of a figure anymore. I guess Peter would trust him and Tony would trust him.
Right.
It just seemed, it's like something you have to think about too hard, I feel like. And the more you think about it, the less it makes sense.
I feel like he just wanted him to give him the glasses and, like, that's all he was supposed to do.
Yeah.
And then was like, oh, I think I'll try being in charge this week.
Yeah, yeah. I think he kind of does say something like that in that end scene too. I think he's like, oh, I gave him the glasses like you asked me to.
Yeah.
But then like this dude from another dimension showed up. So yeah, I guess that makes sense. He gets swept into it. He got too excited.
It's like when you're house sitting and then you're like, oh, I live here now.
This is my dog.
It's really interesting thinking about the way that you guys viewed all of the side characters and that stuff in terms of Sam, you know, you mentioned at the top that you didn't like this one quite as much as Homecoming. And I think like I said this at the beginning, but I didn't realize just how true it was until we had this conversation, that my appreciation for this movie really is deeply rooted in how much I appreciated Mysterio as a villain and Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. I was like, oh, I forgot that you're really good at this, like at your job of being an actor. I don't think about you ever.
Oh my God.
But you're good at your job, Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah. To me, I think Vulture is probably, Homecoming is my favorite Marvel movie, I think. And Vulture is my favorite Marvel villain.
He's also a fantastic villain, yes.
I feel like he felt like his like grudge, he has a grudge against rich people, and like he thinks he's the kind of person that Peter actually is, and the way that they just like reflect each other and bounce off each other to me was just really engaging. And his whole conceit to take that villain who's like, in the comics he's just like a doofy old man who can fly, and to use his name to make him into like this really interesting character who's like making his living on the edges of the superhero world, kind of just like tied it all together and made it feel realer than this one does. This one feels a little bit more generic to me than that one did.
Also, like the way he fits into the larger universe and the fact that this whole universe kicks off with a superhero who also like was an arms dealer. Like he was a legitimate arms dealer, but like he was a fucking arms dealer. So to then it took a bit before you could really get to the place, but that there was a payoff to that like this larger universe had seeded this villain in a way that was also really satisfying.
The natural extension of like, which Mysterio was too.
Yes.
Mysterio felt like he was set up very well to me. I guess maybe I don't know. I like both of the villains and both of them a lot.
Yes.
I think it was more like the setting and like how they treated the side characters that took me out of the movie a little bit.
That's fair. I love Vulture as a foil for Spider-Man in Homecoming. I like the way that the conflict and the introduction of the characters and Peter's, you know, need to prove himself. I think all of it works together so well in Homecoming. I think that Far From Home represents like a really great escalation of everything mm-hmm. that was in Homecoming, because I feel like the type of conflict and stakes and story that were presented in Homecoming wouldn't have worked as well post Endgame, because it's not just a continuation of the franchise, it's also a sequel to Homecoming, and in sequels I think that the primary goal is to expand the world, you know, help the characters grow, teach us something new about the characters. Like, everything ought to be ramped up. And I felt like everything that could be ramped up in this one was ramped up. You had higher stakes. You had a more threatening villain. You know, it wasn't just... Because if Vulture doesn't, you know, if Vulture wins in Homecoming, you know, more weapons are out there, but it's not, you know... I'm killing half of London. I'm targeting these five important characters. I'm going to be the new, you know, everybody's going to revere me as a hero. He felt like Syndrome to me. I forgot to say that, but I kept thinking about that in The Incredibles. Mysterio felt so much like Syndrome to me, and I loved it. Anyway, I just felt like it was a really good escalation of everything. Like it felt earned. It felt mm-hmm. more heightened. And I really enjoyed that about this movie.
And I know we're comparing him to the villain in the first movie, but also, like we mentioned before, like this is coming post Endgame. So mm-hmm. he's the next villain right after Thanos. And so I think that, you know, you had to have something that felt that big.
Yeah.
Well, not as big as that, but it felt it was OK. It like held up. It wasn't like so rinky dink that while we were watching it, we're like, oh, OK, we went from like, you know, universe destroying half of the people. This still felt like it pulled you in and that you were invested.
I think rinky dink can be OK with Spider-Man, though. I think and like maybe to some people, maybe I just don't know if I needed the escalation was not a problem that I had with it, but I feel like Spider-Man can still face like very homegrown threats and still be engaging movies.
Yeah.
I think it's tricky in the MCU though. So just speaking to the movies, it feels a little bit like they have set Ant-Man up as the one to kind of have the, like, you know, have the smaller threat like villains. So I don't know, but I think because of the way that they positioned Peter vis-a-vis Tony, it makes it harder for him to have the smaller homegrown villains.
I think it would have been hard to have a homegrown villain anyway, because at the beginning of the movie, that's what he specifically says he only wants to deal with. Like, he's like, I'm just the neighborhood Spider-Man. I don't want to deal with these like big world saving things anymore. I want to go on vacation. I want to come back and stop bank robbers and be done with everything. So I think like, I don't know how you really would have told this story if you didn't have like a giant, you know, world stopping Avengers level threat, as Mysterio put it, because I think that it wouldn't have been enough to draw that responsibility out of him.
Yeah. But maybe in some way that is putting the character of Spider-Man in like a kind of situation that he is not specifically created to face.
That makes sense.
Like, even still in the comics, he's fighting like things that are very directly related just to his own personal life. And like once a year, he'll go off and fight aliens and stuff.
Yeah.
I think actually I am curious to see where we go next, because I think that in a lot of ways, the idea of ending this movie with outing him does create the opportunity to say, okay, now what is his real life, right? Like, so we had to, this is the movie immediately after Endgame. So we had to find a way to plausibly have Spider-Man be the next movie after Endgame. And I like that part of how they handled it was like, it's a fake out. It was sort of a blend of, you know, yes, this is, you know, the next, this is, we have to give you stakes that are meaningful after Endgame, but also the only superhero that is fighting the stakes is the teenage boy, so like we have to justify that too. You know, like how do we make sense out of all of that happening? But I think the fact that we end this with him being outed does then set it up to pull back to a smaller story about his daily life.
That's a really good point. I think you're right. I think that is going to ground like later movies. You know what I was thinking about? Sorry, I just realized this was the first villain that he beat in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because Vulture destroyed himself because his suit blew up and he didn't actually defeat Thanos. First he died and then Tony got him. So this is actually the first villain that he defeated.
Oh,
yeah. Yay, go Spider-Man! so proud of you, baby.
We're so proud of our boy. And then he still got him, like, in the end, like, because he had that contingency, he still, like, ruined his life.
Yeah, did anybody else think it was weird that he didn't have his suit AI talking to him anymore?
Well, he wasn't using that suit.
I guess so. I just thought it was weird she wasn't even there at all. Like, they didn't even mention her.
I know. What happened to Karen?
I know. Poor Karen. I guess she got blown up when that suit got blown up.
Well, he had to leave her. She was hard to pack, okay? So that case was huge, you know?
Oh, yeah. Maybe she's in the iron spider suit. Right.
Yeah.
Okay, she's
fine. It's a 50-pound limit, guys. And on that note, thank you to Taylor and Sam for joining us this week, and thank you all for listening. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on Spider-Man Far From Home. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on patreon.com/snarksquad, and there you can find polls, live hangouts, and other bonus content. You can also find us on Twitter at snark_squad. You can find me at My Name Is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
I am at Tay_Simons.
And I'm at Slam Schultz.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. We'll be back in your feed next week.
Bye.